everybody. We're still just sound checking up here, but please feel free to help yourself to beverages and appetizers if you haven't yet. We're Feisty Pants, if you were wondering.
That's her radio voice.
It's not a radio voice. Just a microphone voice. I think my radio voice would be something more like this, a little bit lower, a little more relaxing.
Hi, welcome to Feisty Pants. You ready?
Could I hit you up for a dollar? Can I hit you up for another? Well, if you ain't got change I could hold, that's okay, you owe me nada, nada. Nada, nada, nada. Could I follow you? You ain't my father. If you can't get me there, why should I even bother? But if you ain't got much good to say, zip it up, I don't need nada, nada. But trouble comes and goes.
If I'm overthrown, I can say I never saw it coming.
If trouble steals me fast,
like an atom blast, they might say there wasn't time for running.
He never stood a chance,
then that boy knew nothing.
Hello, 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 hello. It works. Hi, everyone. Hi. So we're only about 15 minutes behind schedule, which is right on schedule. So if you are interested in eating, the buffet line is ready. So you're going to start over here, take your plates, and move across this way. There are orange labels in front of everything that will tell you what they are.
Good evening, everyone. If you give me your attention, please go ahead and keep on eating. But we do need to... Am I too near? Stay closer? Okay. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Kurt Smith. I'm the incoming board chair of New Hampshire Peace Action. And... I'm looking forward to get to know a lot more of you. I'm a relative newcomer to New Hampshire Peace Action. And it's an honor to be succeeding Lynn Chong as board chair. I must say it's also a difficult act to follow. But I feel honored in that regard. I think the work of New Hampshire Peace Action is especially important today. Looking around the world, what do we see? Horrific wars in Syria and Yemen, and only getting worse. Increased tension between the U.S. and Russia. And the dangerous situation regarding India and Pakistan hasn't gotten much attention, but I was reading in the New York Times the other day that that tension is still there, worse, if anything. We also see our own country planning a $1 trillion nuclear escalation, and you'll be hearing more about that later on. So your support of New Hampshire Peace Action is welcome and needed. So I thank you for being here. Continue to enjoy the dinner, the speaker, and the music. Thank you very much. Yeah.
So I've heard the food's terrible. Is that good? All right. I'm Will Hopkins. I think almost all of you know me, but if you don't, I am the... Director of New Hampshire Peace Action. This is my eighth fall fundraiser as director. Thanks. Wanted to welcome you all, say thank you for coming, thank you for your support, and call your attention to the year in review highlights, which is a few pages spread out over the middle of your program book. And I'm not going to go through month by month, but you'll see I started a year ago, October, When I asked a question live on MSNBC, there were over a quarter million reads and an article about the question and Secretary Clinton's answer to the question, over 130,000 views of the video of that question. In December, we had a rally to support, this was in response to Governor Hassan saying that she did not want Syrian refugees in New Hampshire. We had a rally in solidarity with Syrian refugees. And as you flip through, you'll see that pretty much every month, this tiny little nonprofit, and I know on a day like today when we've got a buffet line and we've got a fancy venue, feels like we're big, but it's really, most of the time it's me and Doreen in the office. We're one and a half staff. We pull this off with a budget of about $72,000 a year. So we are about as tight a little nonprofit as employees staff. And after seven years of doing this, a little over 7 years, I look around and I early on I had a lot of problems saying, hey, can you give a donation of X number of dollars, and talking to donors and asking people to give money. When I think of the work that we've done, when I think of the things that we have accomplished, it doesn't make me, I can ask for that money because I know that I'm going to stretch those dollars further than just about anybody else can. So Kurt took over at the end of, or at the beginning of 2016 as our new board chair, taking the place of Lynn Chong. And Lynn, where are you? You mind coming on up here, Lynn? So Lynn, 6 years ago, at a board meeting when our board chair had left and we had tried to recruit among the board for new board chairs and it just wasn't happening, and Lynn said, well, I guess I could chair as an interim. And while we continue to look for a new board chair. And so we looked and we didn't find anything, and we kept looking, and then we just kind of stopped looking. And 5 years later, Lynn reminded me that she had come on as interim board chair 5 years ago, and that we were supposed to be looking for a new chair, and asked if she could be relieved of that duty at the end of 2015. And Kurt was kind enough to step up and take over chairing the board. But I did want to say thank you to Lynn and recognize her in front of kind of this core of our membership. And we thought about getting Lynn a plaque or something, and we thought this would be better. So this is a plate, and you should ask Lynn to have a look at it later. It's painted by Jessica Ellis Hopkins, who I know. And it says, with gratitude for your 5 years of service as, quote, interim board chair. Lynn Chong, 2010 to 2015, New Hampshire Peace Action Education Fund.
Thank you so much.
Here's a bag if you want to. And I think I need the microphone. So with that, according to my handy-dandy program book, that brings us to, wow, we're way ahead of schedule. I was supposed to spend a lot of time reading everything in this year in review, but you'll have plenty of time to look at it, bring it home, look it over. And I also want you to think about it as you hear from some of our youth. Hannah and Nick and Allie, would you mind coming up?
Hello, everyone.
Hi, I'm Hannah Eliason. I go to Concord High School, and I am a senior. I am the membership advocate for New Hampshire Peace Action, and it's a great group of people.
Hello, everyone. My name's Nick Dundorf. I'm a junior at Oyster River High School in Durham, New Hampshire. I also reside on the board of the New Hampshire Peace Action Education Fund. I got involved with New Hampshire Peace Action and its youth contingent, New Hampshire Youth for Peace and Justice, a little over a year ago now, after I attended their Peace of Mind Youth Conference. It really changed my life. It got me into the world of activism. I now do a lot of work with 350 New Hampshire and 350 Action with climate activism. And it brought me from a place of growing up in kind of hectic times with a fear-mongering media where I felt very powerless as a young person who not only wasn't really recognized by most people, I just didn't feel like I had a voice. And that voice came to me through Peace of Mind and then through New Hampshire Peace Action, then New Hampshire Youth for Peace and Justice, and then 350 New Hampshire. And that really, there's a place for organizations like this.
I got involved with New Hampshire Peace Action through the Peace of Mind Youth Conference, which is a long weekend where youth from around the state can come and meet other kids who are interested and passionate about social injustices and social issues as I am. And it provides a safe community for people who don't have that safe community at school or at home, and people really understand you. And what really brought me to that was I love peace. I really do. I really love peace. And I think it is something that many people can't see peace because they live in such hostile environments. And even in Concord, New Hampshire. And I think that through New Hampshire Peace Action and through their work with students and peers such as myself, they really create an environment where everyone feels accepted. And that's what's special to me about it.
In these days, in this election cycle, and these times of war in Syria, or nuclear proliferation, we need organizations like New Hampshire Peace Action. We need these people, and these people who will stand for what's right and will always speak up even when others are not speaking, will always comment when something needs to be said, when something's wrong, and will give someone like me, a 16-year-old and then 15-year-old kid, an opportunity to make change in our world, in my community, really everything. But there is one thing, an organization like New Hampshire Peace Action, it's small, and it also requires a paid staff to be functional. That requires money. So as you guys are all here tonight, we'd like to ask you guys for money. And before we do that, I'd like to recognize all of our $1,000 donors and have them stand up. So anyone who annually donates $1,000, please stand up.
Or more.
We would really like to acknowledge you and everyone who gives to New Hampshire Peace Action, because for youth as we are, we can't do this alone, and you guys really help us strive to make the world a better place.
And I would like to ask those donors to stand up again. Sorry to keep you moving.
And continue standing.
And continue standing.
Sorry, we're going to make you stand and stay standing for a long time.
This is a fundraiser and aerobics. Would anyone like to join them tonight?
Oh.
Also, tonight you see our monetary thermometer.
And every time we hit $1,000 more, but if you can't commit to $1,000 up front, we do encourage to give monthly as an organization. So for $1,000, it would be $86 a month.
And obviously, $1,000 is a lot to give at one time, but we figure if it's a monthly donation, that seems a little easier to swallow. $84 is—it's not too much. And you know, New Hampshire Peace Action. New Hampshire Peace Action, as a nonprofit, likes to have their money coming in monthly so they can keep track of things. So if anyone would like to commit to contributing $84 a month, please stand up. Anyone be interested?
We would like to acknowledge anyone who donates $500 a year.
Or would like to donate $42 a month, which would come out to $5 and
$500.
Would anyone be interested in donating $42 a month?
If you could please stand up.
There we go. We got one.
Oh, we got two.
That's two.
That's two. That's two.
That's two. All right, gone. Anyone else?
Oh,
yes. Oh, absolutely. Sorry.
If you're giving $42 a month, if you're giving $4 a month, if you've given $500 this year, please stand up and be recognized. Thank you.
Let's do a dong ding.
We have a few people here who purchased a table for this event. Stand and let us recognize you. Please stand and stop. Purchase over and down.
Now, would anyone be interested?
Right. If anyone donates $250 a year, can you please stand up to be recognized?
I was presumptuous.
Okay, now who would like to join them by giving us, or the action, $21 a month? That's four.
Right,
four. Oh, something's wrong with this gong.
Pretty good. Not all the way up, but I'm impressed. Good job.
We're getting.
Good job, you two. We're not done, though.
like to recognize anyone who donates $100 annually to New Hampshire Peace Action. Please stand up. And would anyone like to join them by giving a monthly donation of $9?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
One more time, just because.
Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight and helping to support Hannah and I and youth across the state and the peace movement. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Feisty Pants.
I think we should have Will record that and we can play it at the beginning of every show.
Feisty Pants.
I can't do it. Hey, we are Feisty Pants. Thank you so much for having us. Thank you, Will. I know I have seen many of you before. I was here 2 years ago. I was Rachel Vogelzang then. Now I'm Rachel Vogelzang Burlock. And I got that and a baby. So it's been a busy 2 years. Now we're Feisty Pants. We're really happy to be here. We play around town. Most of the time we spend with our kids, which is exciting. The five-year-old is not here, otherwise she would be right here trying to sing with us, which is sometimes okay, but not all the time. And if a baby's crying, it's ours. Probably. Unless someone else has a baby hidden somewhere. No? So we're going to do a few originals and a few covers for you this evening. Yeah, I can do that.
Should be normal way to play it. You can normally turn the keyboard up.
Oh, I usually tune it up, that's right. Is it an A or an B?
Yeah.
Got it, sure. All right. Just some last-minute key changes. So this first one we're going to play is called Blocks. You can listen to this one on the internet if you want to. This was off of my album that came out a couple years ago. This is called Blocks.
It's not worth rebuilding these walls. I've tried and I've cried.
foundation was strong. Blocks may be stacked by one, it's true. This tower's blueprint calls for two. So tell me, do you still really want to play? Tell me, or will you turn and run away? Tell me, should I put all my blocks away? Tell me, do I go or do I? Blocks keep falling down.
She said, kill time. She's going to get water. She's got the water. She's coming back to the piano. Sorry, I panicked. I didn't know what to do.
You did great.
This song, we're just playing a few songs now, and then we're going to have the wonderful speaker come up, and then I think we're going to play a couple songs at the end, right?
Yes.
That's what they told me. I'll do whatever they tell me. But this song is a song I've been playing since I was six. Well, I used to just lip sync it back then.
Make a change for once in my life. Gonna feel real good, make a difference, gonna make it right. As I turned up the collar on my favorite winter coat, this wind is blowing my mind. I see the kids in the street without enough to eat. Who am I to be blind, pretending not to see their need? A summer's disregard, a broken bottle top, one man's soul. They follow each other on the wind, you know, because they've got no place to. Why I want you to know I'm starting with a man in the mirror, and I'm asking him to change his ways. No message could have been any clearer. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself and make a change. Been a victim of a selfish kind of love. It's time that I realize that there are those with no home, not enough to love. Could it be really me, pretending that they're not alone? A willow deeply scarred, somebody's broken heart, and washed up dream. They follow each other on the wind, you say, because they've got no place to be. It's why I'm starting with me. I'm starting with the man in the mirror. I'm asking him to change his ways. No message could have been any clearer. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself and make a change. Get it right while you got the time. Darling, you look look wonderful tonight.
Thank you. I'd moonwalk, but I just ate. Did somebody just say Freebird? There's always somebody. I swear, it's a conspiracy.
Nada.
This song's called Nada. It's an original. It's going to be on our upcoming album, which will be out in the next couple of decades or so. Last time I recorded an album, I didn't have a 4.5-year-old and a 9-month-old. So the process is slower.
A little bit. It is a little bit tougher with all the...
But if you listen to it now and memorize it, it's almost like you have the recording.
So pay attention.
That's, you don't have to pay attention.
Sorry. All
right. Ready?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3. Can I hit you up for a dollar? Can I hit you up for another? Well, if you ain't got change I can hold, that's okay. You owe me nada, nada. Nada, nada, nada. Why should I follow you? You ain't my father. If you can't get me there, why should I even bother? If you ain't got much good to say, zip it up. I don't need nada, nada. But trouble comes and goes. If I'm overthrown, I can say I never saw it coming. If trouble steals me fast, like an atom blast, they might say there wasn't time for running. Never stood a chance. Damn, that boy knew nothing. Nada, nada, nada. If I could lend a hand, you know I'd offer. But we're all children here. We are our sons and daughters. And I can't fix yours if I ain't got mine. Nada. Trouble comes and goes. If I'm overthrown, I can say I never saw it coming. If trouble steals me fast, like an atom blast, they might say there wasn't time for running. Never stood a chance. Damn, that boy knew nothing. Take any more, wait any longer. If this place won't look after me, why should I keep wasting time? Yeah. Nada, nada, nada.
Nada.
Trouble comes and goes. If I'm overthrown, I can say I never saw it coming. If trouble steals me fast, like an atom blast, they might say there wasn't time for running. Never stood a chance. Never stood a chance. Never stood a chance. Damn, that boy knew nothing.
We good for now? Next second?
Yeah, next set.
Okay. We'll come back after?
We'll come back after.
Whichever you say.
We had one more, but we can. Yeah, absolutely. Perfect.
Yes, so do we. Cool.
Does it sound okay out there?
The volume is great.
Okay.
It's hard to tell.
All right. So let's hear it for Feisty Pants. And they're going to come back and do some more music after. So when my board and I were brainstorming who to have speak at our fall fundraiser, it very quickly, so one of the threads that came out from my presentations on the Islamic State this year came right up to the top. And that is, when I have gone out, I am a white male, Protestant. I am a military veteran and very much come to my presentation on ISIS comes from a military philosophy and military theory background. And what's become very clear in giving these presentations is that there's really something missing. There's something that my perspective cannot provide on what's going on. And one of the things that comes up is a concern for the enormous amounts of violence that are being perpetrated against women in Iraq and Syria. And another is the role that Islam is going to need to play in deflating this violent social movement. And I think it's really hard not to see the parallel between the white supremacist movement here in this country that is as inflamed as it's been during my lifetime. I was born in 1980, and I don't think I've ever seen... I've never seen a time when it was okay in New Hampshire to display Confederate flags, or to say, I support someone who's openly white supremacist for president. I've never seen a time when it's as okay as it is to treat other human beings as less. And I'm alarmed, as I know people in the Middle East are alarmed at the rise of ISIS. And it became clear that the last thing we needed for a speaker right now was another white guy who thinks he knows how to solve our problems. And we came to the conclusion that the ideal speaker this year would be a feminist Muslim theologian, somebody who understands the Quran, somebody who understands Islam and the sociology of Islam, and somebody who can come at this and say and show us a perspective that a lot of us don't get to see otherwise, wouldn't be able to come to on our own. And so we looked for experts, and we found out that one of the world's leading feminist Muslim theologians is at Tufts. And so we got really excited at this, and I was able to get in touch with Celine. So Celine Ibrahim, and I'm just going to read the bio because I think you're gonna get a lot more from her than me continuing to babble about why we picked her. But Celine Ibrahim lectures and publishes widely on topics including the histories and theologies of interreligious relations, Islamic religious leadership and higher education, Islam and Muslims in North America, Islamic family law, Muslim feminist theology, and Quranic studies. Ms. Ibrahim also serves as an associate at the Center for the Study of Jewish Christian-Muslim Relations at Merrimack College and is completing a doctorate at Brandeis University in Arabic and Islamic Civilizations. She's deeply committed to Islamic scholarship and fostering interreligious learning environments. I'm really, really excited to hear this talk, and I know a lot of folks are. Before she comes up, I just want to say, I every year I feel like most folks walk around with this feeling of intense, heavy helplessness about our political situation and about the future of our world. We took on 350 New Hampshire as a special project because we recognized that, for instance, the United States Navy tried to make a computer modeling program to predict when conflict would erupt. And they found that the only way to be sure to know when conflict will erupt is if you take away a population's access to clean drinking water. They go to war 3 days later. And so in Syria, we see a horrible drought being caused by climate change that has led to a civil war and that has contributed to the rise of ISIS. We need to be peace activists. We need to be environmental activists. We need to be feminist activists. We need to be Black Lives Matter activists. We need to go out and we need to work for a world that goes beyond war. And that means being more than what we are. So I hope you all enjoy this talk. Thank you all for supporting the work we do together. Thank you all for being here. And I'm going to turn it over to Celine.
Oh no, they might tether me to the podium. Does it? Yeah, it looks like it's fixed. Good evening, everyone. While they're working the tech, I think I'll just start a little bit here so we have plenty of time for questions and answers, which is always my favorite part. I want to say peace and blessings to everyone. Assalamu alaikum, which you can reply if you'd like to. Wa alaikum assalam. Peace be upon you and upon you peace. My husband recently called to book a hotel in a Muslim country, and the first thing they say to one another, you know, my husband sitting on his couch and the receptionist in the hotel, hello, peace be upon you. And this is the greeting, you know, of Islam, and this is really, you've heard it before, but this is where the majority of Muslims, you know, come into the world hoping for this peace, hoping to carry this spirit of peace. And I see that through the room tonight. I want to recognize everyone who made this event possible, the staff back there in the kitchen. Let's give it up for the staff. There were a number of little people helpers around here, so let's give it up for the little people helpers. And for the lovely music, just how beautiful. And the youth, and I'm told that apparently the category of youth is anyone under 40, so if you're under 40, you give it up for the youth tonight. And we really need all generations, all parties on board. Of course, we have a lot of work in front of us as peace activists, and it's just delightful to see this work happening at the grassroots, all hands on deck efforts. Let's go. Great. So I have to say, in that bio, it's been about 3 years since I've been at Merrimack. However, I am still a PhD candidate at Brandeis. So just to set the record straight, I'm a chaplain at Tufts University, and then I have these wonderful three other faculty appointments, one at a Jewish rabbinical school in Newton, Hebrew College. Some of you might have heard of Hebrew College. Also at Andover Newton Theological School, which if you go to a church, and it's a Protestant church, your pastor most likely was educated at Andover Newton. They have this historic mission for educating not only Protestant clergy, but Christian clergy and now interreligious leaders more broadly. And I also have the great pleasure of serving on the faculty of the new Boston Islamic Seminary, which is the first effort to make a Muslim seminary that's American through and through, but that also imbibes the principles of classical Islam in their pure form. I know when I say imbibes the principles of classical Islam, people, you know, automatically maybe go to some type of medieval penal code, but there's so much depth and breadth in the Islamic tradition that we're working to, you know, bring into the public sphere and the public discourse around Islam. So the game plan for the evening. Before we get to the ISIS bit, and I promise you I will get to the ISIS bit, I want to talk a little bit about our own dominant public narratives here. And these are narratives, I think that this crowd understands them, knows them, but sometimes it helps to name them. And also, particularly in this election season, in this election cycle, I want to just put more vocabulary out there for you to be able to talk to your neighbors, for you to be able to analyze, maybe even with another depth of meaning, how our public discourses actually feed into the propaganda of the Islamic State. So the big argument that I'm going to be making throughout this presentation is that our best efforts here as local citizens, as people at the grassroots, is really to work on the narratives. Because this, I mean, the physical violence is one thing, but we have a lot of power to craft narratives and create narratives. And this is what extremists on multiple sides do. I mean, this is what white extremists do. This is what Muslim extremists, I don't like to call them Muslim, because if you know what Muslim means, it means a state of the heart in peace and surrender to God. So certainly I don't want to call anyone who's wantonly killing as a Muslim. I once asked a dear friend of mine who was a mentor, I said, I didn't know she was Muslim at the time. She's kind of one of those undercover Muslims that doesn't wear a headscarf. And I said to her, I spotted her from across the classroom, and I heard her answers were so profound, and I worked up the courage. I said, came up to her and I said, are you by any chance Muslim? And she said, I'm trying to be. And this is the spirit of how we identify who is a Muslim. It's by the actions. Do their actions bring a sense of peace into the world and touch the lives of everyone around them with this same spirit? So anyway, I'm going to put some of those different narratives about who and what Muslims in Islam are. Also, I'll address the commonly asked questions, because I've realized while speaking in public places that there are a few kind of common tropes, and that if I just hit them in my presentation, that we can get into more interesting question and answer sessions. And then I'm going to go specifically to the strategies for doing the peace building work involving Islam and Muslims. This is my most of the time. Unfortunately, not literally, although I would like to be a rock climbing instructor, perhaps in another decade or so of my life. But the dominant narratives around Islam and Muslims are so strong because they've been there for centuries. And I don't know if any of the other people in the room love reading history. It's dark for the most part, but also there are some hopeful moments. But when you do look at the depiction of Muslims by sort of Europeans going back to maybe 12th, 13th, 14th century or earlier, you see that some of the same tropes that are used in contemporary political cartoons, which you'll have being a few in a moment here, can be traced with a long history. Muslims as monsters, Muslims as mistreating women, and in the medieval times, sometimes it was the licentiousness of the Muslims, and now it's the oppressiveness of the Muslims. But it's always something in relation to women. So I'm going to get to some of those themes as well. I just want to talk a little bit about the inspiration for being here in the room tonight, and it is building. Will, you spoke to it so well. This multi-base, broad-based coalition that wants to come together across religious differences, across racial differences, across ethnicities, across nationalities, across abilities, in all ways. And so I want to also encourage you, if you have honest questions, don't be afraid to ask them, because this is the spirit of the room tonight. We're here to learn together. And I want you to take a moment and answer that question up there. How do you know what you know about Islam and Muslims? Maybe you have friends. Maybe, as a lot of people in the room, I realize, have gone on a trip to Israel-Palestine. Maybe you've been able to watch some documentaries that are particularly informative. And then maybe you're, like many of my relatives seem to be, just slammed with anti-Islamic propaganda over and over and over again, no matter where you turn. And I keep getting from my grandmother, I have to say, I've been Muslim for over a decade now, but I did come into Islam. And so I have a few relatives that maybe have not had the privilege of learning about Islam in formalized settings. And so my dear grandmother, bless her heart, still sends me this propaganda and says, "Celine, is this true? Is this true?" And I have to say, well, the last time it wasn't true. It's probably not true this time or this time or this time. But it's almost a full-time job to be negotiating this intense propaganda campaign. And what we have to remember here is that it is a well-funded, well-organized Islamophobia network. And it receives up to $40 million plus dollars in funding. And as I'm sitting here watching all of you kind of contribute to this effort, it almost feels like the scales are tipped in such a way that getting out the positive messages about who Muslims are, college students aspiring to a degree in engineering can support a family and, you know, follow their American dream. All of these types of narratives are suppressed. So it appreciates ways in which we have to maybe look for ways to elevate these less commonly told stories.
Yeah, I know. I think it's the connection. One moment, please. Technical difficulties. Check. Here we go.
Who is the we that makes up this civic fabric? Next. So as I mentioned, these are the images that try to tell you who, and in this particular slide, who Muslim women are in particular. Their support of violent terrorism, their... I keep moving it. I'll hold it like this. They're locked in their clothing choices. They're just waiting on the West to come rescue them by bombing them. You know, so you see that these narratives, while they strike up immediately the affective of dimensions, they really mask over a lot of what's happening when you get into real communities. And what also happens with the anti-Islamic propaganda is that a single incident such as the Malala Yousafzai shooting in the head, which is one single incident in one single village, then becomes the meta-narrative, not only for all things Afghani, or not only for all things brown Muslim, but then the meta-narrative for all things Muslim, such that all Muslims apparently... are against women's education, which, by the way, education is a fundamental duty on all Muslims that was instituted in early 7th century by the Prophet Muhammad in the Quran. So it's quite ironic that this is one of the tropes. And this is not to say that there aren't people, a limited number of people in a specific geographic region that are targeting girls' education for a variety of historical reasons, which have something to do with the U.S., if you know your history in the region. But it's this taking of one specific incident and then creating this meta-narrative about it. So I once attended a rally on my campus that was talking about the rape culture on college campuses in the U.S. And now, what if I took that narrative and mapped it onto all college students broadly, all Americans broadly? And I'll tell you a little anecdote to illustrate how this works. I was sitting in a park in Egypt having fun with a bunch of kids kicking a ball around, and about a 10-year-old boy asks me, "Can you go out at night in America, or is the mafia all over the place?" And so you see there are kind of narratives on both sides, depending which kind of media, television you're consuming. And so we have to be very alert, because even if we don't intend for those narratives to seep in, or even if we think we're immune to them, the narratives about the other will always seep in the place of real lived experience and exchange. So I'm sure you've all been familiar with these images of the Muslim rage. And so when white Americans in particular are asked what characteristics define Muslimness, they'll say things like anger, violence against women, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this all feeds into the meta-narratives about who ISIS actually is. So now, instead of telling the narrative of ISIS as a group of gangs that emerged in the vacuum of the state, that oftentimes creates a choice for ordinary people who would not like to be involved in war, either pick up arms and join us or die, essentially. Instead of telling these stories of what has created the power vacuum in Iraq and in Syria, we just go immediately to images of Muslim rage. Now, I actually can appreciate this cartoon. Can you all read it? So we have the executioner here from the Islamic State saying, convert to Islam or die, and then the prisoner saying, you first. And at least you get the irony here. And most people don't actually know, and I can say this because I can read statistics on what people think Islam actually says. Most people are of the opinion in the U.S., when Pew polls them, Gallup polls them, that Islam says the killing of Christians, or Islam mandates the killing of Jews, and that somehow any Muslim who's not doing that is just not abiding by their principles, or is a progressive Muslim, or something like this, when actually the reality is exactly the opposite when it comes to what Islamic texts and traditions actually teach about the religious other, about violence against innocent people, et cetera, et cetera. Now here you have a TV, and so ISIL is not Islamic. And thankfully some of our politicians have been able to promote that rhetoric to try to counter the meta-narratives about who and what Muslims are. But now you have the two ISIL fighters saying, what does Obama think we are, Mormon? Okay. A lot of these are from right-wing websites that, I even laugh when I see them because there is a deep irony in them. So that's not to say there is a specific kind of violence that's recruiting among Muslims who are particularly vulnerable, either because they're new converts and don't understand the fundamental principles of Islam, or maybe they have actual criminal records and so they're already inclined to participate in some of the violent actions that go on. But here, so the trope is playing on an actual reality that does exist. You can look out and you can see a very few number of people, you know, committing atrocious acts. But these narratives also, these narratives mask the fact that other groups do commit these acts. Now, when you think about the world's global population, about a quarter are Muslims. About a billion of the world's population are Muslims under 30. Now, what groups are the most likely to be engaged in specific kinds of acts of violence? Well, it happens to be young boys in particular, and not to perpetuate a stereotype, but just to say there is a certain vulnerability that comes with youth. Now, they're not Mormons, maybe, because if you look in the world, the percentage of Mormon youth is incredibly low. So it's not, to make these comparisons completely ignores demographics, it ignores the historical narratives of who's colonizing who, and who's deprived of resources, who can't access clean water, etc. So we really, it's hard to nuance things because sometimes a quick point to a statistic about, thank you. Three's the charm, right? I should just maybe stay in one place, but then I might put myself to sleep. Hopefully I'm not putting any of you to sleep. It's sometimes hard to tell more complex stories. It's easier to point to this incident here. It's easier to say, as I once received last week in my mailbox, a campaign flyer, I'm going to try to be nonpartisan, so I won't say who it's from, that just simply had faces of brown men with Orlando, New York, you know, San Bernardino written across the top. Well, they've left out a lot of other mass killings in deciding that it's only brown men that pose a problem. And so this intertwining of the racial other with the religious other is a huge problem, not only because it undermines fundamentally the fabric of kind of who we are as people, but it makes it easy to dehumanize and to say, you know, whiteness is superior, Christianity is superior, etc. So we have to really work hard to counter any of those narratives, and even if they privilege us at some points. And I'm very much aware that I walk through the world as a white Muslim, and that the experience of my brown students, for instance, is radically different. A quarter of American Muslims, and by some statistics even higher, are African American Muslims. So I have many women in, for instance, my Muslim Student Association at Tufts, who are daughters of Somali immigrants to America. So here they are, black, Muslim, a woman, and children of immigrants. Okay, so there are ways in which those of us who can walk through the world with a little more ease because of our racial privilege, or because, you know, in some cases, because we belong to a dominant religion, it's really about taking on the responsibility that comes with this privilege of not having to face the discrimination. So here we have a really awful caricature of President Obama, and the wife is asking, do you think ISIS is scared? And the husband, I'm just presuming here, the husband says, no, but I'm sure they're surprised to find out they aren't Islamic. Okay, so again, playing on this trope of really honing it in that these people who are doing atrocious acts are Muslim. And not only are they Muslim, they're doing it because their faith tells them to do it. And this is the point that's hammered in over and over and over again. And it's significant here that you have, a couple that maybe you might presume has not had a lot of experience dealing with diversity, or maybe they don't have Muslim friends. And I'm reading into the cartoon, but this is what I see when I go out, is that young people in particular, especially if they've had a chance to form friendships, and many of you also, I'm sure, have friendships across religious or racial divides, but it makes a difference, because then it suddenly isn't about an abstract concept, but it's about your pal Ali, as I like to say. You know the pal Al effect? This is a sociologist, Robert Putnam, who writes about the fact that when you know someone, your relationship to the issues that affect them also changes. So I think, as an action step, I'd encourage you all to get a Muslim buddy. And unfortunately, there are not great numbers of us in New Hampshire, but maybe we can put out the message that it's a nice place to settle, including for Syrians. Okay, next. Okay. Now, again, I touched on this very briefly, but let's talk about the recruiting issue. So this cartoon says, ISIS job fair, because you just want to get ahead. And again, you can imagine from which side of the political spectrum of the U.S. these types of cartoons are coming from, although they're by no means limited to that perspective. And again, you see, look at the size. Look at the size of the fighter. And then, the blood of the, the guilt of the blood. Now, we have to, as a country, and this is hard for me to do, but we have to hold ourselves to extremely high standards when it comes to things about our own accountability in military action. And you'll hear, for instance, stories of Malala Yousafzai, who, was shot in the head by the Taliban. But what about all of those children who were killed by drones? So we have to hold ourselves to a high standard and notice that the forms of violence might be slightly different, but they're violence nonetheless, and it's lives lost regardless of whether they're You know, the violence can be blamed on the other, or if the violence is actually perpetrated by people who represent our we. Okay, this one's, I couldn't resist putting this one on because I haven't really talked strategy, and maybe, Will, you'd probably as you know, be a better strategy person than I would on this, but this says, see, no boots, and you have, help me here, Uncle Sam with a toe in the ISIS war quicksand. Now, a lot of the rhetoric has been around the strategy of just bomb them. On that same flyer that had the brown men with the cities that had experienced political violence in the U.S., if you turned it over, the policy recommendations for keeping America safe, I think I just gave it away, the policy recommendations included banning Syrians into the U.S., calling Islamic terror, and there was another brilliant idea. Let me just think of what it was. Oh, banning immigration from Muslim-majority countries. Okay, so we have to get a little bit more sophisticated. Yes, there is a war going on. It might actually require some type of U.S. Contribution to creating the peace. But we need to be proactive in going against this narrative that just bomb them. You know, the more you bomb and obliterate, the better the problem will get. Because this is just not true historically. And I mean, you're in the room tonight because you know that's not the way that politics or diplomacy works out. And it's certainly not good for the people on the ground. So it's a complex situation. But the more we can resist that rhetoric of the more just obliterate them, the better off we'll be. Okay, I'm going to go into a little bit of the gender piece. Are people still awake? Are you still with me? You know, get another cake or whatever it is. Get salad, perhaps. There's still salad left. So you have here Muslim face coverings, and on the one hand you have a woman in a niqab, and on the other hand you have a moderate Muslim with a bag over the head like nothing is actually going on. And this is a charge that I get a lot. Where are the moderates? Why aren't they speaking? But yet anytime there is an event that a panel, a program that involves Muslim moderates, it's really hard to make a story out of it. If it bleeds, it leads, and moderation just really isn't that interesting. If you have ideas for how to make it interesting, I'm really all ears. But it's a constant battle to try to get the average, regular Muslim voices heard. And it's not that people are walking around with bags over their head, but a lot of people are walking around very scared to lift up their voice in the political realm because there are already communities that are under surveillance, that have been subjected to family members just simply disappearing. Yes, it happens in America as well, particularly in the wake of the 9/11 when many families just suddenly came home and their husband wasn't there or their father wasn't there. So it has happened, and we haven't fully held ourselves accountable for the ways in which the specific targeting based on race or based on religion is still to some extent, a large extent actually, continuing to affect not just American Muslim communities, Sikh communities, Hindu communities. You have things like the Oak Creek Massacre that targeted just brown people who were different. So it's really a disease that we need to eradicate from our own society before we can think about how to, you know, bring people together overseas in a conflict like that. Okay, so I recently wrote a few op-eds, and one of the op-eds I wrote was about Hijab Solidarity Day, which happens to be February 1st, where the creators of Hijab Solidarity Day thought the same idea, well, you don't really know the experience of someone until you walk a mile in their hijab, okay? And so I wrote an article, I wrote in a bunch of places, you know, I did what what academics do. I just changed around the paragraphs and the words and put it out to a lot of different places. No academics in the room, or else you'd really get that. And the responses that I got from just, you know, encouraging people, just see what this experience is like. If you do not choose to join in with modern women in our, capital O-U-R, country, to continue this ongoing struggle for equality, you are more than welcome to return to the many countries that require this form of ancient costume dress. I'll consider that a compliment, thank you. Welcome to America. Please try to evolve or leave. Okay, so this, there's so many points in there, and I think you hear them with me, and I saw some cringes on people's faces. If Muslims want to be accepted at school and in the workplace and in the community, they will make an effort to look like everyone else. Okay? I treasure my spiritual values and keep them private. I choose to look accessible and approachable and not a threat to anyone. Okay, so you see how these many narratives about what it means to maybe want to cover your hair and how that's been interpolated to mean anti-American, anti-feminist, anti-community. It's a working to be able to lift up multiple ways of dressing as being American, to be able to consider that not wanting to wear a bikini is just as American as wanting to wear one. Okay, so we have to preserve this plurality, or we lose something of the soul of who we are as a community that is built on diversity, pluralism, and inclusion. Oh, more. There's more. Okay, by wearing a hijab, you're pushing your religion in my face and making yourself ugly, too. If civilization is to cope with the problems that confront the planet, like from global warming, we will need a planetary sense of unity. I was with it so far. Islam is inimical to that unity and is therefore dangerous. Okay? And it's one thing to know this rhetoric is out there. It's a whole other thing to realize that people are directing it right at you and that your picture is out there and that if people just looked a little bit, they could, just target you. And this actually happens. I'll tell you a very funny story about this. I'm a doctoral candidate, and as part of this process, I had to form a committee. And I came home and I said to my partner, my hubby, I am so glad that Suhail Leher, this wonderful Harvard-educated scholar, has agreed to serve on my dissertation committee. And so he says, oh, I haven't heard of his works before, and puts him in, and he says, do you know he's an Al-Qaeda operative? Like, no, I've known him for a very long time, and I, in fact, know that he writes specifically works that refute the narrative of radical Islamic violence. But what happens is that groups that are part of this anti-Islamophobia network, they'll target individuals who have a public voice and who are using that public voice, and they'll create this whole smear campaign, which shows my dear dissertation advisor, who happens to have a beard and who happens to be brown. He comes from South Africa, but from an Indian family. He's from East Africa. He's not even from South Africa. But in any case, targets this, got a particularly scary photo of him with his beard, with a kind of wide-eyed expression, and put out a YouTube video such that when you Google his name, this very esteemed scholar who's actually writing brilliant articles refuting the violent rhetoric is now labeled as an Al-Qaeda operative. And it's so believable, in fact, that my husband, who's a Muslim, believes it. Okay, so there's a sense at which this propaganda is sophisticated. It plays on people's fears. And in the same way that it's targeting that really scary phenomenon over there, it's also taking very specific people in the Muslim community who have a voice on these issues and is squashing that voice. So what you find is that the radical right are the only people who in fact agree with the radical, self-identified Muslims who are perpetrating the violence. So you have this strange agreement across both sides, with everyone else in the middle quite baffled and some of us deliberately silenced. Now, I myself have been able to escape a lot of that because I happen to work at institutions that protect me a little bit, like Hebrew College, like Tufts. But it's always a conscientious thought that you wake up with, knowing that there could be a national smear campaign against you, basically. Anytime someone deems that you're a threat to peace and tolerance and diversity. Okay, go ahead. Oh my goodness, I'm only like a little bit of the way through. But here are the questions. Where are the moderates? I talked about that a little bit. Why does Islam treat women so harshly? Why do Muslims hate the West? And how can a religion that's bent on destroying all disbelievers fit into the modern world? How much time? I'm probably, I stopped wearing a watch. Okay. So here I wanted to show you some names of people who are dear to me, who are very boldly being Muslim in the public sphere and very actively putting out ways for Americans to come together and work on the extremism in our midst. Extremism that comes from self-identified Muslims, and extremism that comes from various other fragments of the population. We like to joke that if a violent attack happens, not joke in a funny way, but joke as a critique of national discourses. If a black man commits a crime, then it's probably drug related. If a person who's brown from a Muslim-majority country commits a crime, then it's terrorism-related. And if a white person commits a crime, then it's mental health issues. Okay, so we need to be able to talk in more sophisticated terms. And these are some of my dear colleagues in this work. Dr. John Robbins, who also, like me, is a convert to Islam and can navigate these spaces, because if you just saw Dr. John Robbins and you looked at Dr. John Robbins, you would not necessarily assume Muslim. And this is helpful because it starts to undo that xenophobia that's tied up in the anti-Muslim rhetoric. Farah Pandith, she has a brilliant essay on defeating the propaganda of radical Islamists in the Washington Post, I believe, this week. So jot down her name, look it up. She's at the Kennedy School now, a formal special representative to Muslim communities at the Department of State. And I intentionally chose these three because I want to point out that American Muslims, they're white, they're, in the case of Farah, Indian, but American-born, and in the case of Imam Majdid, Sudanese. And so the community is so diverse, and helping to tell those stories and propagate those stories of Muslims from all different backgrounds who are really working on issues of building American civic fabric. So it's so important. Now this is a picture, this is a mosque in Burlington that was recently vandalized, and you'll see it was written on the Mosque USA. And what they wrote on posters as an interfaith campaign against this type of rhetoric was, "We are USA. We are American. We consider ourselves as part of this fabric. Some of us have been Muslim in this country for generations, four or five generations. Some of us have been here since the slave trade happened." So we need to help perpetuate those stories that Muslims are not over there, that Muslims are in our midst as well, and that they understand themselves to be an important part. This is great. "Muslims hate pork, beer, dogs, bikinis, Jesus, and freedom of speech. My question is, what do they come to America for?" This was text, was a tweet that I happened to pull off from the conservative Hammer. Now, first of all, if you know anything about Islam, you know that Muslims consider Jesus to be a prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. So obviously this person got the other stuff right. I mean, dogs, it can go either way depending on what school of law you follow. It's a little more complicated. But you get the point that, is this rhetoric what is quintessentially American, or is what is quintessentially American our core values? Now, I'm going to speed through the rest of this, but I have to say, oftentimes Muslims who are deemed as okay, acceptable Muslims, are called progressives because somehow they're reinventing the Islamic tradition in a sanitized way that's meant for a modern period. And this is simply not true because the actual values of Islam are very progressive. When you go to the roots, when you look at what the Quran says about women's rights in the early 7th century, and I'll get to some of that. So this idea that Muslim feminism, although to call it feminism is sort of to jump on the feminism bandwagon, which I do to be able to communicate who I am and what I do to people, I would say that so many of our early women scholars, and I'm talking again 7th century all the way through the modern period, they were doing what contemporary feminists do. And here's, I'm just, you know, putting out names in case people are actually, people come to me after lectures and say, well, what should I be reading? And so I'm kind of putting the works up there of people who happen to be women, because I'm focusing on that now, but who are doing a really wonderful scholarship, not reinventing the Islamic wheel, but just going to the texts and traditions that are there. Now, when you go to the texts and traditions, you see that they affirm women's independent earning and holding of wealth. The Prophet's wife, Khadija, peace be upon her, was a businesswoman. She proposed to him. He worked for her. So any rhetoric about women not being able to work outside the home and all of this, it's not really a reflection of what Islam actually teaches. It affirms women's pursuit of knowledge and literacy, which when you think about what else was happening in the early 7th century is quite what you might call radical in a good way. And affirms women's worship. So women are completely integrated into all of the prayer rituals, the fasting rituals, etc. And again, remember the time period and remember what else, what was the dominant standard for women at the time. And we've many other things. Women in the Quran are not responsible for the fall of humankind. And in fact, the story, this is from a Turkish manuscript, and I'm actually forgetting, like 15th, 16th century. But what you see here, you see Adam and Hawa in Hebrew, so Eve. There is the story of Adam and Eve in the Quran, but actually they both hold responsibility for approaching the forbidden tree. Exactly. And in fact, God speaks to them in the grammatical dual in Arabic. Arabic has, we don't have this in English, but there's actually a form to say you to people. There's not an idea of original sin. The idea is that human beings have an angelic kind of potential, a spiritual potential, but they're also material, and they incline to the things of the world, and sometimes they make mistakes, and actually that's part of the design of the human being. That's not an original state. Actually, the original state is a purity, a goodness, and a God consciousness. You'll notice the snake. You can't really see it properly back there, but I was quite fascinated that this entered what seemed to otherwise be an Islamic manuscript. And so I asked my hubby, who has no knowledge of what Genesis says about snakes in the Garden of Eden, I said, what do you think the snake is doing in the picture? And he paused, said, maybe it's about to bite them? So there's a totally different, even though the characters are the same, there's no narrative of the serpent coming to Eve and tempting Eve and then Eve tricking Adam. Not at all. Some verses in the Quran on spouses, and of God's signs is this: God created for you spouses from among yourselves so that you might find rest and mercy in them, and God ordained between you love and mercy. Spouses in another verse are described as garments for one another. And this is the Arabic grammatical form of reciprocity here. And the believers, men and women, are protecting friends of one another. Another verse, wives have rights corresponding to those which husbands have in equitable reciprocity. Someone once asked me when I projected these verses in a talk, did you make them up? So I can assure you, you can Google Quran.com and make sure that I did not just make those up. Here's another one. I'm dubbing Islam here the equal opportunity religion. For Muslim men and women, for believing men and women, for devout men and women, for truthful men and women, for men and women who are patient and constant, for men and women who humble themselves, for men and women who give in charity, for men and women who fast, for men and women who guard their chastity, and for men and women who engage much in God's praise, for them has God prepared forgiveness and great rewards. That's another verse from the Quran. And these are just a few. There are many more that could, in fact, be highlighted that elevate the status of women. This is one of my favorites about Islam that gets lost, that God is not referred to as a father or a male, and there's no conception at all of a hierarchy of maleness over femaleness. So now, how do you reconcile what you maybe hear in news or you know, maybe even have observed? Well, a lot of times, these are the principles, okay? Now, we're human beings. We fall short in our principles. And we have to be able to, maybe as non-Muslims, also say, well, yeah, we have principles too, and sometimes we fall short in those principles. And to be able to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. Because so frequently what happens is people point to our values, we don't denigrate women by our speech. Let's just go with that one. And now look at what they're doing in that Muslim country. Look at how they're talking about women. Okay, so we have to be able to, again, I won't actually say it because I think you get where I'm going. Here's one of my favorite verses of the Quran. We created you male and female and have made you nations and tribes that you may know one another. Indeed, the most noble of you from God's perspective is the most pious. So not only is Islam an equal opportunity religion when it comes to the questions of on gender, but it's also an equal opportunity religion when it comes to people's personal relationship with a God. Now, next slide. The Quran also includes messages. I wanted to highlight another great voice here who many of you, especially if you're interested in peace activism and in particular Muslim-Jewish peace activism and in particular activism in Jerusalem and Israel-Palestine, I definitely recommend checking out Hamera's works. But it's a religion that recognizes the religious other as valued and protected. In fact, the line that most Muslims, even if they're not very schooled in Islam, will know by heart is that there's no compulsion in religion. And here's a chapter from the Quran that is one of the first that young Muslims learn. And it essentially says, oh, you who don't believe what I believe, you won't believe what I believe, nor will I believe what you believe. You is your religion, and to me is mine. Okay, so this is what Muslim school kids, if they're learning anything about Quran, is one of the first chapters of the Quran that they learn if they're learning Islam in a traditional way with the structure and discipline of a classical education. I also wanted to point out, maybe some of you, and this one's for the youth and all of us who are under 40, that many times when you actually look at people who are doing peace and justice work in the U.S., oftentimes they actually do come from a Muslim background. And so here's Ibu Patel, who is head of Interfaith Youth Corps. And I put these slides up to remember to mention these people so that you'd leave with concrete ways to plug in to the people who are doing great counter-narratives and peace-building work. I think we might have to end soon and open up for questions and answers. Okay, so I think I'll end there. And there's much more I could say, obviously, but we're running out of time, and I want to hear your honest questions. And I've heard a lot, so you don't have to worry about potentially offending me. Just, you know, I appreciate your honest questions. Muslims have a custom of not clapping for one another because they said it feeds into the ego. So they say it's better to send good thoughts and prayers someone's way. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of tendency to take things out of context and just build a political ideology around something taken out of context. And this is what we see over and over. One of my slides that I didn't get to show you was a picture of the word Hebrew with underneath it says, "The Bible says that men must make coffee." Hebrew. Okay? And this is a lot of what is happening. It's just rhetoric taken utterly out of context and repurposed to serve a war machine, essentially. And it works because a lot of places in Muslim-majority societies, the actual Islamic education has been completely and totally undermined, such that young people are actually very vulnerable about this because, unlike the classical period where the first thing you learned was the Quran and core Islamic principles, now what's happened because of poverty, because of secularization that has come in, young Muslims in a lot of places simply aren't getting a good quality Islamic education, which makes them kind of susceptible to all types of you know, politically expedient propaganda. Oh, yeah, here, and then we're going to get a woman's voice. So what are the principles that, yes, exactly. I hear it. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So Islam is surprisingly coherent when it comes to what the scripture says because it's in a very condensed historical period. There was no Quran. 23 years later, there was a Quran. It's in relatively recent history such that the manuscripts, early manuscripts, have been preserved. It was orally preserved. So people in China were reciting the exact same thing as they were reciting in Morocco, you know, a couple of decades after the early community established the polity that it did in Mecca and Medina. Now, the Quran is never taken, if you're doing Islamic theology properly, it's never taken out of context. It's always understood vis-a-vis the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, which are also passed down orally from generation to generation. There is room for interpretation, but there is a very specific regimen for how interpretation has to happen. And it has to be coherent. So, for instance, you can't take one part of the Quran and completely ignore another part of the Quran and consider that good hermeneutics or good interpretation. There's an emphasis on coherence, and there's an emphasis on the teachings of this particular figure that are very widely well known because he actually was a public figure for a very long time, and because people were, you know, going after him, documenting what he said, what he did. And so there's a level of coherence Again, if you're doing the theology properly, if your aim is to take things out of context, then that you can have a field day. Let's go for it. Yeah, so is it necessary for a person to convert to Islam if they're going to marry a Muslim, right? There's classical codes. The Quran is not super specific about this. What the Quran says is good women for good men and good men for good women. But the medieval codes, now a lot of what comes down is in Islamic family law is derivative, again, using principles of interpretation. And so those principles say, because of the dynamic of marriage, in which a man is actually fiscally responsible for all of the support for his wife, I keep reminding my hubby of that one, the Muslim scholars have said that the man in the marriage, because they have all of these duties and responsibilities towards the wife, and because the wife is considered the more vulnerable of the two partners, because she's being essentially taken under the protection of a man who may or may not have her best interests in mind, the Muslim scholars specify, and maybe they just wanted a bigger dating pool, is that the women in the marriage could be believing women of any, as long as they believe in God, that they could be an eligible partner. But they wanted upright Muslim partners for their women. You can, and I write about this in kind of my academic work, about how convenient to stack the dating odds in Muslim men's favor, right? But there's also another way that you could read that is to understand the intent is to provide some type of holistic framework. And as a chaplain, I help orchestrate marriages for people. I'm not like a, what are they? Like matchmaker, that just popped into my head. Not like in a fiddler on the roof sort of way, but people come to me, and oftentimes they're interracial, interreligious marriages, and on paper, oftentimes the man will have to profess Islam in order for the contract to be valid. Because Islam resides in the heart, and because you're encouraged as a Muslim not to be a vigilante against other Muslims, it creates a lot of openness for people to just be Muslim and be in a marriage because they want to be in a marriage, not necessarily because they want to be, a practicing, ritual-abiding Muslim. Let me just see who has questions. I'm going to run through. Let's put all the questions out there. I'll do my best to answer all of them. Yeah, so this is great. Tabari, who you mentioned, just to illustrate how exactly this happens, he was a scholar and went around collecting all different traditions. So his job, he was just making an archive of all the opinions that are out there. He wasn't necessarily saying that they're all true. And then modern voices who want to advocate for a specific position just lift them out of his book, regardless of what he actually deemed to be their authenticity, their reliability, and simply say, oh, it's quoted in Tabari. So it's a lot of these kind of tricky maneuvers that if you're actually schooled in these things, you can recognize very easily. It's a kind of playing on people's naivete for your own political ends, yeah. Oh, I promised I'd take questions and then we go to answer, so let's hear the questions. Thank you.
I figured it would bomb everybody in red because you've never seen a fat terrorist.
Can you grab my pen so I can just jot things down? Okay, thank you. Good questions, yes. Nusra Front represents many different groups, and this is the thing, to say something like ISIS or, you know, the terrorists over there, we lose again that specificity. And so I think the objective on that side is to portray themselves as a coherent front, but actually when you start to see it's very fractured. So I'm not the best person to speak to the specifics. But I can just say that I think we need to look a little beyond the big names and sort of see that this is a very localized conflicts that just happen to be playing into meta-narratives. Let's get a woman's voice. We've only had one, I think, so far. There. Yeah, let me take that one right away, because you can't solve human rights concerns until you have some level of political stability. It's just like trying to plug, what is the expression, a fire hydrant, you get the image. And the other thing is, it's interesting that when we talk about breaches of justice abroad, they're human rights violations. Then when we look domestically, you know, there's social issues that hopefully we'll figure out in good time. And so oftentimes I encourage people who are, you know, rightfully concerned about what's happening abroad and what our role might be or have been to either help or exacerbate the situation. There's also this delicate balance that has to happen between, like, looking at homelessness in Harvard Square, for instance. I don't know what the equivalent is in Concord, but, you know, seeing some of those issues as human rights issues as well. And so I don't have, you know, this grand answer for how we're going to fix the really kind of brutal, grotesque images. One thing I will say is simply do not watch or share or subscribe to the repeated viewing of the propaganda, because you are doing exactly what the people who wrote the propaganda want you to do. And it's hard because we, as a culture, like violent movies. We like, something that reminds us that, oh, the world can be scary. And there's some type of psychological need to curiosity to see these grotesque things. So I just also say, you know, put a check on it, and don't continue to perpetuate or share or demand the kind of news stories that are based on if it bleeds, it leads. Okay, you've had your hand up for the longest time. Complicated, yes. Mm-hmm. I think it's a messaging thing. I think as activists generally, and I'll include myself here, we think in concrete terms: how many people fed, how many signatures on the petition. And sometimes I think if we thought as carefully about these three words, that when you combine them together, you know, will have an affect on people. You know, how do we tell those messages such that, and it's happening, it really is happening, that people want to share the positive messages. And it does, you need action, but you also need the narrative, and you have to be doing both at the same time. But it takes work. There's no easy, we need to think of a better metaphor than silver bullet, right? There's no one easy thing, easy solution. Yeah. And I will get back to the question over here, I realize I said, and then I think someone needs to just take the mic out of my hand. Yeah. Oh, they love me because I can talk to people and they're not scared of me when I talk. It's, you probably won't believe it. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But actually, it was the things that I read in Islamic teachings about women that actually first started getting me thinking about Islam. And it was also meeting Muslims and just admiring something of the strength of their character that comes because they're waking up at 4:30, because they're going 30 days, you know, only eating food and water for a very, you know, specific time, you know, because they're so very conscientious, because every action has a prayer and every action comes with an intention, and it's a way of walking through the world. And I would see that in people and kind of go, I want some of that, whatever, however you got to this constitution that you hold, you know, teach me how to do that. And that's really what it was. It's this classic paradigm of where's your homework? The dog ate it, right? We do have this tendency, because it's hard to be good people. It's hard to hold ourselves accountable. It's hard to do introspective work. And sometimes when you're doing the you know, collective introspective work, then you're labeled as unpatriotic, when it's the exact opposite. Oftentimes, I mean, I do this work because I'm so, you know, happy to be part of a polity in which I can look around and, you know, feel the diversity and the you know, emphasis on accountability, which, by the way, is, as I see it, very Islamic values: diversity, accountability, you know, seeking the moral good. So I you know, buy into the greater social project that I think this country tries to represent. You know, to the extent that we're successful, I personally think it has to do a lot with human nature, in that we'd like to sometimes think we're doing better than maybe we are, or like to kind of do the you know, more egotistical, take the more egotistical posture and say, well, it's not really me who has a problem. So I encourage people to actually just do more of the introspective work, because peace building, and I emphasize this, it always starts, you know, it starts with the relationships in the family. It starts in the relationships, you know, with the extended family, with the neighbor. The Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, once said, the angel Jibril, which is the angel of revelation, who many of you might also know by the same name, has spoken to me so many times about the rights of the neighbor that I thought they were eventually going to get inheritance rights too. And this is the spirit of, you know, how we have to carry ourselves in the world, that Some of our time is spent thinking about our own kind of moral composition, and that's really hard to do. Yeah. What was the, you played this wonderful song that, that tied into that theme. What was the second song you played about the man in the mirror? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, alhamdulillah, like praise to God, that's what the Muslims say. But the funny thing is, you're supposed to say it if bad befalls you or if good befalls you, just say thanks to God for either one, good or bad. But this is really inspiring to hear, and I think that's exactly the type of sentiment. People have come up to me and said, I want to be a Muslim ally, how can I be a Muslim ally? And I think especially young people get this, because there's so many ways that young people are also forced to feel otherized, you know, for any number of reasons, that there's an emphasis on you know, creating this welcoming culture. So, I mean, it's about education first, because a lot of those narratives rely on things that are just so blatantly false, but you have to be able to know, you know, what's the true of it and what's the false of it. So again, it's a lot of it is just trial and getting yourself in places where you can practice having those conversations. I posted Interfaith Youth Corps. I don't know to what extent they're active in any of the colleges around this area, but certainly I think you're maybe a high schooler, but going soon to college. College campuses, they're really great with a lot of opportunities, and just taking the time to go into spaces that are radically unfamiliar and learning to become aware that you know, my way of seeing the world is one of many, and cultivating this kind of spirit and this ability to go back to being the Buddhists call it like a beginner's mind in things, and just putting yourself in a lot of in circumstances that you have the experience to do things that are out of your comfort zone in a good way that expand your views of you know, who's human and what they value and how they live their lives. Mm-hmm. Equal reciprocity, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's the classic, I write about this in an article, it's, yes. So to what extent it's not equality in the paradigm, and I want to stress this, and it's a feminist principle, so hang with me on this one if it's not your discourse. But the feminist principle that stresses equality misses out on a big thing, is that we're sexed bodies, and that women have, because they have all of these responsibilities, and I'm not saying women only have responsibilities, but, you know, I carried a baby for 9 months and my husband could not carry that baby. You know, I went through some things. There's just specific biological things that mean, like, direct equality is great in the political realm when you're talking about the rights to vote, the rights to earn wealth, hold inheritance. But when it comes to this unit of the family, and when it comes to social provisions around the experience of pregnancy and of child rearing, 2 years, 3 years, you know, some women even more now, are nursing. Now that takes a whole other kind of social support system to do this. And so if we simply stress equality, we actually lose out on this, the particularities of what it means to be a gendered body. Now, that's to say that there's also social constructions that make it advantageous to be male in society and disadvantageous to be women, and those are the things that we can work against, but without losing this special consideration that some women do go through this experience, and it's unique and requires unique family structures and social structures. Thank you so much, everyone. I appreciate your questions. Oh my goodness, I didn't answer this question. I didn't have my pen down, so I only got to write. What do we do for the dispossessed? Or was that another question? Okay, so yeah, now I remember. Thank you. So the extent to which foreign policy informs, let's call them grassroots Muslim opinion of the U.S., and it's a, is that what you were asking? So the anti-Muslim rhetoric that comes out here just gets piped directly into their videos, and I don't watch them. I sure do not want to watch them, nor do I want to get flagged by anybody for having watched them. But from what I hear from friends and colleagues who work within government agencies where their job is to watch the propaganda and see the patterns, you can see it directly in almost an overnight sort of way that if something is said on the national stage here that's overtly anti-Muslim, these messages about go home, you don't belong, you're not welcome, they show up right away, and they're the mechanisms for recruitment. So there's a direct link. But yeah, thank you so much.
So we're about 25 minutes past where we wanted to be. I did not want to stop that conversation because I thought it was going really wonderfully. So what I need everyone to do right now is raise your right hand. Say, I state your name. Do solemnly swear to leave my name tag in the box by the door on my way out the door. So I'm going to turn it back over to Feisty Pants. I am not going to pick up the microphone again. What I want to say is a few things. Number one, anybody who feels like, even though I know it's past your bedtime, if you feel like you have a little bit of energy left and can help clean up, we'd love to have you. We made way, 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 way too much food for this event, so there are leftovers that can go home with you for a small amount of helping us clean up after everyone's gone. So think about it, and don't forget to leave your name tag over there. I love you all. I am so grateful to have you as a community that I can play this role with. Thanks for a great night. Yeah.